You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, singer-songwriter David Brookings. How are you, David?
What's up, Nikki? I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. And you are a Commanders fan. It was a heartbreaking weekend, but you know what? We were just talking about this off the air. You got the next couple of years to be very thankful for, and I know you and my buddy Eddie, who was a co-host on this show, die-hard Commanders/Redskins fans. And you have endured a lot to get to this place. So first, let's just talk about that, because I know you love your football team. It's hard to watch a team you love lose. Now you guys are winning. You had a very surprising season. Did you think they were going to do as well as they did this year?
No way. I thought they'd go 12-5. And oh, so cool. I can't believe they beat Detroit still. So we were playing with house money against the Eagles, and I can't be too upset about anything.
I didn't think the Eagles were as good as they made it look for that game. But, I mean, Saquon Barkley has just had an incredible season. But the Commanders, I mean, I watched that Detroit game. I thought they were going to beat the Eagles the way they played against Detroit. And they just didn't bring that game to the Eagles game. But you know what? They've got plenty more seasons to prove it. I think it's going to be those three teams duking it out in, you know, for the NFC Championship for the next 2 or 3 years. And, yeah, man, I wish your team a lot of luck, because I was rooting for them. I was hoping for the Bills and the Commanders to be in the Super Bowl, and we got the same repeat as 2 years ago. But that's all right. You know what? Next year could be a different story, right?
I hope so.
Well, let's talk about your music. Let's go way back to the time that you fell in love with music. What was the moment of zen that made you love music and want to become more involved with music, either as a songwriter or as a guitar player or a singer?
Well, it was a few things. When I was young, I grew up in Virginia, and my parents always had sort of the oldie station on, and my dad had this box of records. So it was a combination of me hearing things like the Beatles and the Beach Boys and Simon and Garfunkel and the Four Tops and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly, and hearing all that stuff and seeing the Monkees. When the Monkees would air reruns on MTV in the 80s, I loved that stuff.
I love that show. That was one of my favorite shows. When I worked at Guitar Center, I met Peter Tork, and I was really starstruck, because I was like, oh my god, this is one of the Monkees. Great. You know, and I think the show didn't do as well when it was airing as it did in syndication, so I think they actually got a lot more fans when they repeated the show, you know.
Yeah, so I'm definitely second generation Monkees fan, but I kind of found the Beatles through the Monkees, which is weird, but they were my end all be all. Once I was going through my dad's records and I found the Help record, and I thought that I just kind of thought their hair looked like mine, and or I guess mine looked like theirs, and I put it on. It was the best thing I'd ever heard, and I got a guitar not long after that. That was when I was 9. I started writing songs when I was 11, and just really just going from there.
So what were you writing about like at 11, like girl crushes or like, you know, you didn't have the blues then, I'm sure, right?
No, you're right. No, I was writing about girls and just trying to, I think like subconsciously, like really taking in styles and choruses and verses and how you go about what the good parts of a song are, how the chorus needs to pop. And I just listening to all that stuff just on FM radio.
I think you and I are very lucky in that the Beatles kind of taught us what really good songwriting and records were all about, because I also immersed myself in the Beatles and just was so blown away with their level of arrangements and songwriting and chord structure. And, you know, like kids growing up today, they don't have that. Like they don't have songwriting like that. And I kind of feel like they kind of are being left out from that like richness in music, because it's very straightforward and there's less of that now. It's more done with production than actual chords. And I think the Beatles married those kind of arrangements and chords and songwriting and lyrics all together perfectly. And I have to ask you, what was your favorite Beatles song? You played a Beatles song, I think it's Songwriters in the Round, but what is your all-time favorite Beatles song?
Oh, I can't. That's tough. It kind of changes by the day. My favorite period is kind of middle Beatles, that Rubber Soul Revolver era. I mean, but for today, I'll say If I Fell from Hard Day's Night. I go back to that one a lot. The early Beatles is criminally underrated.
Yes.
I mean, everybody's like, oh, I like the Beatles, but later stuff. It's like, dude, have you heard From Me to You or All My Lovin' or just the changes that went into those songs? Nobody was doing shit like that. And so
yep.
I just still marvel at it.
Yeah. And the funny thing too, it's like people underestimate like how smart those chord structures, lyrics, even the arrangements, even like a song like Love Me Do, it just was always well arranged. You know, it's just one of those things where they're thinking about details and attention to details with the recording, and they push themselves. And you also hear their influences. You can hear the Buddy Holly. You can hear the Chuck Berry. You can hear all of it. You know what I mean? So it's kind of cool to see that reinvigorated in new songwriting. And I love when songwriters are influenced by them, because I can tell their songs are good. If you're influenced by good songwriters, your songs are going to be good. That's just the way it goes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What part of Virginia did you grow up in? What city?
In Richmond.
Okay. You know, Virginia has a very rich music scene. Like, there's so many people that have come from, you know, there's Dave Matthews, Pharrell Williams. There's so many hip-hop guys. There's just kind of a vast array of singer-songwriters. Were you in, like, a music community that kind of, like, you know, had that kind of richness in, you know, the people or the teachers or the music programs in schools?
I mean, I was definitely in whatever the late 90s scene in Richmond, Virginia was, because I played all over the West End and downtown. And it was, I think every band has their group of friends and their group of friend bands, friends or slash rival bands. And when you're really young, you play against other bands and battle the bands. And I all that shit was a fun time. So yeah, I guess I was in the scene in that way.
Did you ever see Dave Matthews' band early on, like when they were in Virginia? And
no, because they did more stuff in Charlottesville than Richmond. I did, who was the, is it Tim Meadows, his lead player?
Tim Reynolds, not Tim Meadows.
That's an actor. What am I talking about? Right. Tim Reynolds. I opened a show for Tim Reynolds in Memphis. That was a fun one. And we talked about some of the Charlottesville places like Miller's that Dave Matthews played at a lot and would hang out at.
That's right. He was a bartender there.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is you and I have a lot of parallels, because I actually also opened for Tim Reynolds, but I opened up for him in Santa Cruz. And I was really blown away. Like, he's such an incredible guitar player. And I'd seen him with Dave Matthews, but it was like really awesome to see him do his solo stuff. And I'll tell you, right after we got off the stage, you know, he came up to me and he was like, "Sounds really good, man." And I was like, that was the first time I'd opened up for anybody like that I had always, you know, idolized. And those words meant everything to me. You know, it was just like, man, if he thinks we're good no matter what. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like I have so much really love and respect for him. Yeah, so much love and respect for him. Was he playing with TR3 or was he playing solo?
It was totally solo. Yeah, I was just trying to figure out if maybe it was the same tour, but this would have been like 08-ish.
Right.
It was a little like theater tour he was doing, and I was psyched too to get the call. Do you want to open for him? So it was fun.
That's awesome. And when did you move from Virginia? Did you move straight to Memphis from Virginia?
I did. I was in Richmond till I was 22, and my friend Jason and I, who we were in a band called The Sound together. I wanted to be in a better music town. He had an aunt that lived in Memphis that said, well, you guys can come crash with me. And maybe we should have gone to New York or Nashville, but we went to Memphis, which is really no better a music town now than Richmond is. But really? I don't think so.
That's a pretty bold statement, because Memphis is known for the Blues. And
well, I should say it's historically Memphis is much more important than Richmond. But I mean, at the time we moved, which was 2001, Memphis is largely about its past, and rightly lives off its past legends, and does have a great music scene, but Richmond does too. So I just mean that present day, I don't know that Memphis is better than Richmond, but in my mind, it was, well, I mean, Elvis was there, let's go. Yeah. And I loved it there. It's a great town. I played, you know, Beale Street all the time and all those great clubs, and then wound up as a tour guide at Sun Studio. So it was just, which that place was a dream to work at. It was a great, Memphis is a great town. I miss it.
You and I have another parallel, because you did a couple records. You did three records there, I saw in your bio. I did a record too. I did a record there in 2000. What year was that? It must have been 2012. Oh no, 2014 is when I did that record. And I just was like so in love with everything about that studio, because it's still preserved. It's like walking into a time capsule. Tell me what it was like working there, though. It must have been so amazing.
It was awesome, man. It was really an honor just to meet people from all over the world. A lot of them that had saved up their whole life to come for a trip. People from Japan and Germany and England, and people that would cry when you said, "This is where Scotty Moore played the solo on That's All Right," or "This is where Bill Black stood playing bass." And I met also so many people that were drummer and stuff like that, and just these legends of the 50s. A couple of them were still around. I was friendly with Sonny Burgess and Billy Lee Riley, and these were guys that are long since gone now, but you know, these guys were on Sun Records in the 50s, and it was just a trip. And I'm such a history fan that I really always appreciated that and wanted to do right by those guys. So I just loved working there.
That's amazing. I mean, the cool thing about that is, you know, you just get in contact with all these players that were part of the history that don't have the fanfare like the stars do. But to you and I, they're like museum pieces in the flesh. You know, it's like, wait a minute, what was that like? What were the questions you would ask them when you'd meet them? Because I'm sure you had 1,000 just from being, you know, somebody that worked there.
Yeah, I did. I would say, you know, I was trying to seem inquisitive, but not ask, you know, stupid questions, I guess. But they didn't look at it like that. They were just guys. They were trying to relive their youth by coming in and sitting in and getting a milkshake or whatever at our little 50s style bar we had. But one of the coolest talks I ever had was with Scotty Moore at his house in Nashville. Wow. And my dad and I got to go there and hang with him. And I remember he told this amazing story about how I said, "What were those early tours like? You know, when you and Elvis and Bill Black were just riding around in a car with your gear strapped to the hood or however it was." And he said, "What Bill Black was the bass player, upright player, right?" He said, "Bill's bass used to fall off and we'd have to stop the car in the middle of the night and go back down the road and find it, and strap it back to the roof," and just stuff like that. And sitting in his kitchen with him, and he had pictures of him with Keith Richards or him with whoever. And they weren't even like hung on the wall. They were just kind of in the corner because he was their idol. So he's not bothered about hanging up a picture of him and Buddy Guy. Buddy Guy like idolized him. It was just surreal to hang out with Scotty Moore that day.
Did you get to hear him play by chance? Because like he kind of always was a player, and then there was a drop off where he wasn't playing as much because he was physically not able. That's what I heard, right?
In 2004, we had a big show at Sun out in the middle of the street. Memphis closed the streets off. It was the 50th anniversary of the day that Elvis recorded "That's All Right," and Scotty Moore did come and play at that. And you know, I mean, past his prime, but he was playing that thing still.
Yeah, you could still. You know what's funny is like, you hear these sparks of who they were on those recordings in their old age. And it's like, that's it right there. You know, I want to touch upon something that you said that, you know, kind of struck me. You said Memphis kind of, you know, holds their worth in the history of music there. Do you think they're not doing enough for the present music community, because I've seen a lot of great blues artists that are there now. And I kind of also agree that it's become almost like a tourist haven for what was, and it's not pushing enough artists out of Memphis that are doing things there now.
I think that Memphis, I didn't mean to say there's not great music coming out of there. There is.
No, there is.
I mean that you're right. It's just, Memphis is its own scene. It's its own thing. And yeah, there's a lot of people going there to, you know, it's Graceland and it's Sun Studio and it's Stax. I mean, Stax was a great, great studio, so much history there, but I don't think any of the modern people can compete with, you know, Elvis or Jerry Lee Lewis. And so a lot of the people that have become big out of Memphis have left Memphis, have gone to Nashville or LA, because Memphis at the end of the day, as awesome as it is, it's still a pretty small town.
Right.
I mean, the Memphis thinks it has kind of a rivalry with Nashville, but Nashville, it's just like now living in LA. I lived in Memphis for 8 years, and I've lived in California for 15 years now. And when you really get out of a town like Memphis, and again, I love it and I miss it, but you see how insulated it is and it's in its game for music, and it can't really help but be, because it's just, it is what it is.
What's also interesting too, it's like Memphis back then had a lot of entrepreneurs that were pushing the industry, and that's not happening in Memphis. So the talent's there, but nobody's harnessing the talent like from the industry side, because you had the Sam Phillips, you had Stax, you had, you know, these industries that were like, okay, built on these superstars. And I feel like the infrastructure is not there for the industry to kind of like harness the talent that is there, because I think you need both of them. You know, it's like Nashville has a scene like that, LA has a scene like that, New York has a scene like that. But some of these smaller cities, if they were able to compete on that industry level, they would probably represent their cities even better, because there's so much talent in all these cities. You know, like Memphis has a ton of great blues musicians now, but they're not known like the B.B. Kings or, you know, the Elvis Presleys or any of the Stax artists, you know, the Otis Reddings, you know. So it's really interesting that you say that, because, and I know you weren't like, you know, kind of tarnishing the city. I know you're saying it from a really like experienced level of, yo, you were in the scene and the scene wasn't kind of creating that, because you always like to see a music scene spit out somebody from it. You know what I mean? Like, okay, this person's now in the mainstream because they're in this, and they're representing our city. And I haven't seen that come out of Memphis in a very long time. So it's something I didn't think about until you just said it. That's why I was like, I want to touch upon this, because it's pretty cool. Sure. One of the things you did at Memphis at Sun Studio was give Steve Jobs a private tour. Tell me how that came about, and what was that experience like?
So it was amazing. I worked at Sun from 03 to 09, and in the spring of 2009, I gave it to Steve Jobs' attorney, not knowing it was his attorney. But then this attorney calls my boss one day. He says, my name is so-and-so. I want to bring a special guest in to take the tour, and I want David to give him the tour, because the guy had taken it with me. And my boss said, well, who's the guy? And he said, we can't tell you that, but he's a pretty big deal, and we want it to be a private after-hours tour. So my boss said, okay. So they came in on the same guy, this attorney, came in on a Saturday afternoon. He tipped me $80. This is unusual to get an $80 tip before you've even done a tour.
Right.
He said, just do whatever you did when you were talking to me, and I think he'll really like it. And I said, can you tell me who it is? And he said, no, but I think you'll recognize him. Apple's very, very secretive.
Right.
Anyway, I didn't recognize him. He looked like he was very frail. And first of all, I am a tech guy now, but I certainly wasn't then. I was just a songwriter and made milkshakes and a tour guide.
Right.
So I show him around. I could tell he was really sick. He was hooked up to stuff. Well, he had just had a liver transplant.
Right.
Either had just had it or was about to go in. I think he just had it because he was hooked up on stuff, two stuff. And he raised his hand at one point and he asked me if I could turn the AC down. He was cold, but he sat on the Jerry Lee Lewis piano bench, and I told him, hey, you're sitting right where Jerry Lee did Great Balls of Fire. And he was very intensely just studying everything I was saying. I was being a tour guide is almost like being the TV, where people are looking and listening to what you're saying, and you got to know what you're talking about. By that point, I'd worked there almost 7 years, and I was one of the kind of senior tour guides. So, and I had no fear or wasn't nervous or anything, because whoever he was, I had given the tour to Tom Petty and Bill Murray and George Carlin. Wow. By that point, it was just an incredible place to work.
That's incredible, dude.
It was an awesome place to work. And so after the tour, I gave him a CD back when CDs were a thing. And I told him it was very Bob Dylan and Beatles influence type stuff. And come to find out later, these are Steve's two favorite artists. So yep. Maybe that had something to do with him doing what he did, which was to completely change our life. After he left, they also introduced him under an alias. They introduced him as Steve Easton. And that's not his real name, of course. Turns out that was his surgeon's name. But after the tour, the attorney, he said, thank you, David. You did a great job. I said, can you tell me who that was now? And he said, you really didn't recognize him? And I said, no. And he just smiled and he said, we'll be in touch. And maybe 5 weeks later, I get this email, and the email just said iTunes. And it looked like spam. I thought it was bullshit. I almost deleted it, but it was real. And it was from one of the senior VPs at iTunes at the time. And I called him, and they said, I don't know what you said to him, but he likes you, and he wants to see if you want to come work for iTunes in California.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
And I'm in the back parking lot at Sun in Memphis. And I said, are you serious? This is a joke. And they flew me out to Apple, and I met with a few people, and they put me on the catalog team, where I still am 15 years later. So I'm
so crazy.
I make playlists, playlists for kind of oldies and classic rock and 60s, 70s artists. And it's really a great job. Did
you get Steve Jobs again, or was that the only time you met him?
I did see him one more time. So they moved my family and I in the fall of 2009. The tour I gave him in May 2009. In October 2009, they moved us to California, shipped our cars out. It was amazing. But I did see Steve in the cafeteria 2 months after he retired. He retired from Apple in 2011, and I got to tell him thank you so much, and I promised to think different. You know, the old Apple slogan, think different, and you changed my life. I'll never forget what you did for me. And he said that tour was the only fun thing I did in Memphis. And I hope you'll be really happy here. And I'm so glad I got to say hi to him, because he passed away a month later.
Dude, that is such an incredible story. And you never told me that, you know, when you were talking about working at Apple. When I read that in your bio, I was like, man, that is so, so cool. I have a friend, he's a great songwriter. He actually plays with John Mayer. And he told me one of the coolest Steve Jobs stories. He said they were unveiling the iPad, and Steve loved John's music and was a big fan of him, and had John do a lot of demos for GarageBand and whatnot. And so they all got to hang out with him before. And this was the time when John Mayer was dating Jessica Simpson. So there was a lot of paparazzi on them. And so, you know, they were like, okay, you know, all of his managers and tour managers were like, after you guys finish, we're going to beeline it, you know, so we get through, you know, all the crowds and just kind of like get through the press and make sure we make a clean getaway. And so they all like got ready, like they were just about to like barge through the crowd and just like jump into their cars. And they said they all got through the door and they realized nobody gave two shits, because all of the press and all the media were covering Steve Jobs 50 feet away, and they didn't even look. They didn't even care. And he was like, that was the power of Steve Jobs. Like, that's how like a magnanimous of a character he was in the world, you know? So I was like, it's so cool that you got that kind of intimate experience with him. And yes, he was a huge Dylan fan, huge Beatles fan, really huge Dylan fan. And the fact that you told him about, you know, the history of rock and roll in the room where a lot of it happened, it must have been one of the thrills of his life, you know, to be in that room like it is to be in Sun Studio.
It was so cool. I still can't believe it happened. And the dude is like a Thomas Edison in that vein of a man. And it was whatever crossroads, whatever track my life is on, that moment, that time, I mean, it really did change our life. I love being a tour guide. But, I mean, you know, I made $7 an hour in tips at Sun right. Studio, and this just changed our life and that's moved amazing. Us to California.
What's cool about that, too, is, like, there was attention to detail for you to, like, just give good tours. And you didn't know who was in the room. Like, you didn't know. That lawyer didn't introduce himself as being somebody that, you know, you needed to impress. You just did an impressive tour, and he took note of that. And, you know, what's really cool is, like, when people surround themselves with people that want to be around that kind of energy, it brings those people to those, you know, tastemakers. And Steve Jobs was one of the biggest tastemakers. So it's kind of cool that his lawyer did that, because he didn't need to do that. And it's really cool that you got that experience, and it's because of the work that you were doing as a tour guide. So he wanted that to be a fingerprint on Apple, which is also a testament to Steve Jobs being awesome, because it's good people that make good things happen. And he did that for you, and you also did that for him. And you know, something that I don't know if you've gotten or thought of this, you know, in retrospect, but he was in a part of his life that was really dark. And I'm sure what you were telling him about Sun Studio was a really joyful experience in a time that wasn't very joyful for him, you know? So it's like, it's really cool. It had that kind of impact, and it's changed your life for the better, you know, which is awesome. But let's talk about your music. So we've got three songs. Let's play something. What do you want to play us first?
I should say that there have been, there's 9 records out. I've put out 2 is David Brookings and the Average Lookings, which is full band. And then the others are just solo, but they all have a band on them. Oh, thank you. I think I want to start with Shelby. Shelby's the most recent single. And it's a song about my wife. Her name's Shelby. How about that? But she's like, you've got all these songs about all these other girls throughout time. Where's my song? And she has plenty of songs, but I wanted to be as direct as possible. So. And this is our top streamer right now. I'm fairly small time Nikki, but it's done almost 400,000 streams. And so I'm proud that there are people listening out there. So this is amazing. One of them.
Well, here's David Brookings with Shelby Shelby.
Do it.
so cool. And just one Shelby, not Shelby Shelby.
Yeah. Just one. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. What a beautiful song, man. Great love song. Great arrangement. Cool vocals. Tell me like what the process was like for you to record that song and what it was like to write it.
Well, writing it, I kind of had that intro riff, and then I think the best songs are kind of where the music and the lyrics match each other. And so I was trying to write, something that fit the music, and it wound up being about her. But the other thing I remember about that one is it's the last song of mine I wrote that my dad heard. My dad passed away kind of while I was, it wasn't done yet, but I started recording it when he was still alive. So it's special to me that it's the last one of mine he heard, because he heard me just toil away at the music shit for, 30 years. And then when it came out, I originally wanted it to be sort of the first song of a new album project, but I had a couple demos laying around. So I decided to put it out sort of as an EP where Shelby's the song, and then three demos kind of backed it out. So it came out on all the streaming services as an EP. But that's kind of how it came about.
That's awesome. What a great love song. What a great arrangement. I love like the vocal layering you did on that. It's really kind of like a pop rock kind of like approach to it. Like you really did almost like a Jimmy Eat World meets something more throwback like Beach Boys and Beatles. So tell me what your approach was like with that. Did you kind of intentionally do it like making like a modern version of those old time classics?
I mean, I think that's fair what you're saying. It's always sort of like traditional. Well, it's always sort of some kind of 90s alt. Jimmy Eat World's a good example, meets this classic thing. And I also want it to always be original. So I feel like you can hopefully hear the echoes of influences without it sounding exactly like some particular band. And I think if you're writing about yourself and putting your own heart into it, then most of the time you're going to come through and sound original. To some extent, at least. So I like the classic stuff, but I also like some of the, I love grunge and I love Britpop. And so I would say 60s meets 90s is kind of my thing. And then a lot of the songs are sort of more story kind of songs, where Shelby's just a straight up sort of mid-tempo ballad.
Well, it's cool because it's like you can hear the guitar layering, you can hear like the arrangements and things like that. What kind of guitar did you play on the track? Do you remember?
Well, I did the basic tracks in Richmond because I was back home visiting dad. So I used one of my friend Josh's acoustic, and then Telecaster is kind of my go-to electric. Cool. I'm in that Tom Petty school of, I do love a Tele.
Tele's Strats and Les Pauls. I think I was just telling a friend this. I'm like, he's got all these other guitars. He's like, yeah, I don't have a Strat or a Tele. I'm like, dude, you have to have a Strat, a Tele, and a Les Paul, and then everything else are the ones that you can add to that, an ES-35, right. Like all these other axes. But, those are the meat and potatoes. And I really think it's Strat and Tele, and then Les Paul, kind of lower on the list. Like, that's like, oh, some more candy, But really, you can do everything that you want out of music with a Strat and a Tele. And it's why a lot of those old classic songwriters like Buddy Holly, they only use Strat, you know what I mean? They only did a Tele, or it's like they just kind of stuck with one thing. So I love that. It's I've got an Esquire, which is like an old school Tele, and then I've got a Violin Burst Tele that I love. And it's just one of the perfect
musical instrument to me, like you said. Yeah. It's just great.
I agree. That a Strat and a Tele, I'm like, I don't think I could ever live without those two. It's like all the other stuff is, secondary. So let's play something else. What do you want to play next?
I think I sent in, let's listen to Hard Times. Hard Times, everybody had their COVID song. And so I guess Hard Times, was mine. It was the first song on the most recent full length, but this is a version I sent you guys that we did when we went back to San Jose to do a show. So it's a live version with, David Brookings and the Average Lookings playing at this little place that we like in San Jose called Art Boutique. And if you're ever in San Jose, this place is a mix between like a comic book store and a venue. And
that's
it's geeky themed. It's just a cool bar and a nice big stage. So we played Hard Times there, and it was a really good little show for us.
Well, let's check it out. Here's Hard Times by David Brookings.
Thank you. mosh pit, and this song would have been perfect for it.
That was awesome. What a cool guitar riff. When did you come up with that?
I don't know how some of these things happen. I do remember I was watching TV, and then I went upstairs, and I think I was about to take a shower, and I started hearing it. So sometimes I wonder, did I rip that off of something, or did I just hear something that, I don't know, I was just kind of messing around. But that song's unusual for me, because most of my stuff is kind of chord written.
Right.
Not that that didn't have chords, but that one has that's a straight up riff, kind of runs through it. So
I love riffs. I love hooks like that, because they just make songs for me. It's like I was listening to your words and your melodies, but that riff was just like blasting in my mind right away. It was just like, man, I couldn't wait to keep hearing it. You know what I mean? So it was cool. It's very much like it was almost like a Cure riff. Like I was like hearing you know what I mean? It's like without the kind of like delay and the flanger, it's just like more like a rock, like, version of that, which is cool. Very cool.
Thank you. That song on that record was, might have been the last song I wrote for it. And I was like, this has to be like the first song on the album. That's cool. That has a mood to it. And that's another one, I think, where I hope the lyrics match the music. So that was a fun one to do.
I love that you've made 9 records. I'm making my 9th, I think, right now. And, it's something I always question. Like, I can't believe I'm still making records, but I also love that I'm still making records. My question is a selfish question. What compels you to keep making records?
It's just what I do. When I finish writing one, I chill out for a little bit, and then I do another one. And as I've gotten older, and we're probably, similar in age, I don't care so much anymore about, I think everybody when they start off, they're trying to make it.
Right.
Whatever making it is, I love music, and I think that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And I love my job working for Apple and making playlists, but the heart of who I am is a dad and a husband and a songwriter and a musician. So I'm going to do that. And so once you're at peace with that, like, you're not doing this thing for anything other than because it's what you feel like you're supposed to be doing. And that I think you have to make time for what you love. And so that's just what I do. And when people like it and hear it, I appreciate it so much, because it's so hard to get people to hear it.
Right.
That's the hardest part to me, is like, I think I'm good at music. I think I'm good at writing songs, but how do you get people to hear your shit? And that's the hardest part. But I know they won't hear it if you stop making it. So yeah. I just keep making it.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I think the promotion part is something that I kind of learned as I was making art. It's like, I think the first time I learned about promotion was when I did my senior recital at USC when I was graduating. And I was studying opera, so it was nothing like what I was doing now. Oh, but, yeah. I put together this recital. It took me a year to do it. And man, I like set invitations, like had them designed, like did the whole formal thing and promoted. And, I ended up having the most highly attended recital in school history. We had something like 500 or 600 people there, and it was amazing. But I remember thinking, wow, this is a lot of work, and it's not even the music that I want to be doing. It's somebody else's music, but I'm just singing. And I said, I need to take this approach and start doing that with my own music. And so it really kind of taught me, like, you have to promote everything that you do. Like, the art and creation is the fun part. And the work part of that is like, okay, like promoting it, getting it out there, making sure you're making phone calls, calling radio stations, getting it to playlists, whatever you got to do. And, I think it's a big part of it. But at the same time, you have to keep your mental health in balance, because if you're doing nothing but that, then you're running yourself thin on the art part. And then it's like, you don't want to be promoting it because you're just burned out. You know what I mean? So there's this balance, you know, that I'm learning that, you know, the records are always ahead of the curve of what people's tastes are. And they're always going to be behind on like, oh, what you're doing or what you're kind of making, unless it's hyped and it's, you know, being pushed by labels. And so I'm kind of like learning that art of promotion. But I think the most important thing is to stay inspired and to keep writing, because if you don't make records, there's nothing to promote. There's nothing worth, you know, putting out there for the people in the world to know about it. You know what I mean? So it's weird. It's like, you know, I think art has this weird thing where it's like every artist wants to make something and then just have it be, you know, promoted. And the weird thing is I have songs signed to labels like that I do with DJs, and they promote the hell out of it. And it's got like millions of streams and all kinds of stuff. But it's like, oh, this is the music business. They promote it and they make the majority of the money on it because they're putting all the money into promoting it. So it's like, now it's like I just take that label approach. Like, okay, whatever I make, I also have to promote it and be able to kind of like put something towards people hearing it. Otherwise, it just gets buried under all the stuff that everybody else is putting out. You know what I mean? So it is really difficult. And it's like, now that I get older, I'm not looking for the mass hysteria. I'm looking for like, who are the people like me that love good music and are tired of what's out there and want something that's kind of crafted well. And that's the kind of music you make, David. I mean, it's like you're like niche marketing, but it's also like mainstream on some level. So I think, you know, you have to just kind of like put that promotion muscle forward and just make sure try to get a hold of it or aware of it. You know what I mean? And my question for you too, in regards to that, like, what do you do to promote it in this new market that is so, you know, saturated?
Well, the records are one thing, and then the shows are another. You and I live in LA. It's really tough to get people out in LA, but you never know. You might have a great show. But two-part answer is the average lookings. We had a great gig in Santa Monica last weekend at the Trip, and we played in that middle slot, and I love that. I'd always rather play in the middle than first or last. But the band after us was awesome, and they had, like, you know, nobody was there. And I was telling them, please know, this is the attendance at a show does not dictate whether you're a good band or not.
Right.
And, the clubs don't care. You can have some 19-year-old band up there. They can suck shit if they've got 500 people there. The club doesn't care.
Right.
Another band could be 45-year-olds who are awesome, and nobody's there to see them. So it's just hard. But on the promotion front, I'm lucky that a lot of my stuff has been pretty well received and gotten good reviews. So I've built up a backlog over time of magazines, papers, bloggers to send them to. And I occasionally hire a publicist. But the last time I hired a publicist, 50% of her contacts were people I already knew. So a lot of it is, so then on the next one, I thought, well, I can do this. And then there's a point where the end doesn't justify the means, that how much money are you putting in versus how much is going to come back to you. So I always say, when I make a record, I think 150 people are going to listen to it. And hopefully, some mania would be nice. But I just can't count on that. So I have to. If it's out there though, it's there. So I always joke that I'm on the Van Gogh plan. You know, maybe 100 years after I'm dead, they'll hear the songs.
You know, I started saying that to myself too, and then I realized my YouTube numbers were non-existent compared to like everybody that's kind of an influence on people for music. And so that's why I've been making this huge push on YouTube, because I feel like YouTube is an unbiased medium on some level. I mean, there are variables, you know, like to hit the algorithm, whatever. But honestly, if you make good content, people will come and check it out. And I'm seeing that more and more with even just the slightest of push Whereas like the Spotify's, you have to throw down and the playlists are all paid for. You know how it goes. It's like how it works with all this stuff, you know? So it's just interesting. And you're in the world of playlists. It's interesting that, like, you know, these companies like Apple or Spotify, they should take content that's great and push it out. Not because it's being paid for. It should be because it's good. And it's like a restaurant, like a club should take the same approach too. It's like, you know, a restaurant is not expecting the waiters or the chefs to promote the restaurant and get people there. It's up to the restaurant to do that. Right. It's up to the restaurant to make sure that if they bring 50 people in there, those 50 people are talking about what they were served. So it's like, if clubs were a little bit better about, hey, we're going to promote the hell out of this because we believe in this and we think it's good and people show up, then there's like a trust that if a club is promoting it, people will come because the club has also never been wrong. And the problem is they're just blanketing any bands, any singer-songwriters, anybody, and then it all just gets lost. So there's no sense of like being a tastemaker, none of that. And then it falls on the artist to have to be the promoter and, you know, all those things. So it's just, you know, it's weird the way the industry works, but I'm learning. I'm like, oh, you know what? If I think like a label, if I think like a promoter, and if I can make good content, then the content will start speaking for itself and I'll find those people. And it's been really eye-opening because, you know, like I built my email list from 0 to 10,000 and we were doing a lot of colleges, and then a lot of our college students, they had college emails. So when they graduated, I lost like 6 or 7,000 emails from all the college touring. So I'm like, okay, so the newsletter is one part, but it's not the end all. But what I'm finding is YouTube is actually your best friend. So I've been spending a lot of time on YouTube for the last 6 months, and just like, I'm going to continue making records, but now it's about video and mixing and taking that to another dimension. So something to think about in the future. Do an album, make sure you have a music video, make sure you have some kind of idea of it, you know?
Absolutely. YouTube's great. And the more content you put up, the more people are going to see it. And I've done a few song series where I've done like I covered every single Beatles song.
That's awesome. YouTube.
And when you do that and you have that daily content coming, they're going to come back and you might get subscribers on there. I did the same with Tom Petty and Oasis recently. And they're going to come and you'll find new people, like you're saying, who, one, are interested in some of the same music you're interested in, and then, two, will come back and hear your own original stuff. So
I love that. I love that you're a Tom Petty fan. I played 2 festivals with Tom Petty. I played.
Oh, wow.
It was like a dream. I mean, it was.
Wow.
I've got one of the concert posters. You know, all my concert posters in my home are hung up in my laundry room.
I love that.
It's kind of funny, you know, like it's just like not the place to put, you know, stuff like that. But it's where I can put everything in one place. And one of my favorite ones is seeing Tom Petty. And he died like, I think, 3 to 6 months after that festival. It was his last festival appearance. And then he did the tour. And then he played the Hollywood Bowl. And then 2 months later, he died. So I was like so thankful that I got that experience because he's one of my favorite songwriters and, you know, he's just amazing. But let's play the next song. What are we playing next?
I think the last one I had is One of Us is Crazy, the other one is Me. And this is another one of the it's in the top 5 in our streams. It's also on Mania at the Talent Show. It came out in 2021. I take inspiration from whatever, and there's a line in Black Sheep, the David Spade, Chris Farley movie,
where
Gary Busey's in David Spade's face. And he's like, let's call off Operation One of Us is Crazy. And so that's where it started from. And then
funny.
I just think it's a cool song. So
awesome. Here's One of Us is Crazy and the Other is Me by David Brooks.
Storms are coming in and
awesome, man. Very cool song, very cool arrangement. Where can people find you if they want to find you online? Where can people find you, David?
I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram, and the website is just davidbrookings.net.
And what about your Instagram handle?
Just davidbrookings1.
Awesome. And are you playing any live shows anytime soon?
Several coming up. We're starting a new record. We started the first song. We worked on the first song for it just yesterday, actually. So the next few shows I have coming up are solo acoustic gigs. I play this hotel in Calabasas a couple times a month called Hotel Cambria. And then I play at a fun bar called Petals and Pints in Thousand Oaks a couple times this spring coming up.
That's awesome.
The dates are all on the site. Yeah. Oh, and Mally Sugar Mill, February 18th.
I was just there last night to see the Cock Marshall Trio. So
I saw you were. I love that bar, man. What a fun little bar.
Just like it's always packed. It's got good people in it. Just yep. Like it's like where it's at. You know, it's just a good.
I love it.
Well, David, I'm so stoked we crossed paths through Jody Hill. Shout out to Jody. Yeah,
thank you, Jody. I'm psyched too, Nikki. Thank you for having me on. It's been great to get to know you and
likewise.
I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, man. We'll have to have a songwriting session sometime. But
I would love that.
In the meantime, check out David Brookings' music. Wonderful songwriter. He was on my Songwriter in the Round a couple months ago. But check out his music at davidbrookings.net. And on behalf of David, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Peace, love, and hair grease.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.